Big difference between what's to take place in Iraq, what took place in World War II, and what's offered in The Hague, which is the maximum of a life in prison. And finally, the same rules are going to apply. It's an international tribunal in World War II. It's a national tribunal before judges. The system that most Americans aren't familiar with, where you have judges as the prosecutors and the jury. And, of course, defense offered by whoever you can get.
But what's interesting about the Iraqis is it can be done by the Iraqi people.
Right.
Nuremberg was a combination of several countries sitting in judgment.
And then in
Japan, it was supervised by our military.
Right.
Very different.
And we called it an international tribunal, but Douglas MacArthur was in charge. In fact, Douglas MacArthur is the reason why the head of state of Japan, Emperor Hirohito, is never put on trial. In fact, one of the remarkable things, and you can see some of this, is some of the events that take place. Americans didn't pay as much attention to the trials in Japan as they had the trials a year earlier in Germany. And Robert Donahue, one of those who was there as a prosecutor in both cases, he'd been in Germany at Nuremberg where we shot a lot of this show, and he was in Japan. And there's this wonderful excerpt about the Japanese case that we'll just put it up on the screen for people to see.
Let's put it up.
Shut the hell up, Ollie North. This nonsense about judges and prosecutors. Judges are the prosecutors and jurors in Iraq. Now, this is what you call a move towards democracy? You're just a drug-dealing, fly-by-coke punk-ass out of Ilopano Air Base, noted and written by Celerino Castilla, who saw you fly it out of there for your little pig friends on the international level. The reality is pigs like you should be tried by international court. Forget Saddam for your crimes against humanity, you contra-supporting savage, and your sentence should be death by slave revolt firing squad. Hey, Rich, where's the ammo? You know what time it is. You're listening to 104.1, 106.7 Illinois, 101.1 Santa Cruz, LUVER.com, the world, RadioForAll.net, the universe. Click into your Slave Revolt blog, this Google Web Slave Revolt Radio, and you'll know what time it is. Tonight, since things are off to a late start by technical difficulties once again, we're going to shoot our way into a book that's recently been written about the head Negroes in charge syndrome. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see where they've gone? the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light off is going to do to the rest of the planets in the solar system.
You know what time it is now. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight, what we're going to shoot our way in first with is recently a book has been written called Head Negro in Charge Syndrome. It's a book written by Norman Kelly. And he deals with actually a syndrome that deals with the lack of genuine, authentic black leadership. Now, this can, in a sense, kind of fit in with the show I did the other week called Negro Integrationists, you know, where it's on Condi Rice and Armstrong Williams and Colin Powell and a number of other coons. Of course, some people whined about it. Just like you're going to hear about the whining that he's facing. But we're going to explore it a little bit, slave revolt style. Kelly was recently on a KPFA show. It was the morning show with Philip Maldry and this Andrea girl, woman. And they deal with various issues about the head Negro syndrome that Norman Kelly brings up in his book. So first off, let's hear from Kelly himself as he outlines how Cornel West, in his opinion, is basically a part of the problem. Let's see what Kelly means by that, and then let's take it from there. Check it out.
And I think what has happened with the black intellectual class, or so-called black public intellectuals, particularly those left of center, that they really don't say anything of any important pertinent issues in regard to African Americans. And I think West is basically part of the problem. I give you a case. Every time I've asked people who know West to tell me what it is that he has said, because I read some of the things that he has said, and I can't ascertain any depth of knowledge. Everybody always says, well, he's a very good speaker. So then it started dawning on me, well, that's what's going on in most black politics also, is that it's no longer about having ideas and policies and putting them into effect to better people's lives. It's either acting like a public intellectual, or you act like a black political leader in the sense that you have someone like Jesse Jackson who ran two campaigns in the 1980s, but after his last one, you saw nothing of any substance in regard to like either developing a media apparatus or think tanks or things of that nature. So basically, what my book is arguing, what I'm trying to argue is that there's nothing going on of any substance in regard to African American politics anymore.
Well, your complaint is that they haven't formed a Southern Christian Leadership Conference, or that they haven't created a SNCC, or that they are too egotistical, or what?
Well, my complaint is that it's basically has just become bankrupt. There's no planning. There's no ideas. Everybody's still basing everything on civil rightsism. And that's been over with since the mid-60s. And there's been no development of new organizations. Groups like NAACP really haven't, they've lost a lot of their meaning, but they're still around. There are no think tanks. I mean, I can count on my hand the number of conservative think tanks. You can barely count one significant, well-known black think tank. There's nobody talking about any real meaningful issues anymore. And the very fact that you have somebody like Al Sharpton, who's the best example of the dead end of black politics, now being considered, well, he is what I consider the third HNIC, just really shows you how like, utterly bankrupt. And when it was revealed in the Village Voice that Sharpton was taking money from Republicans and technical assistance while running to save the soul of the Democratic Party, nobody of black stature said one word. You heard nothing.
Well,
zero.
Well, he's right. Sorry, I mean, okay, you have to have an organization to have accountability. There is not one single national black organization that really has the loyalty, the proven respect of the black masses here in America at this time.
What's basically going on in part is that like when Kelly mentions that Jackson set up nothing after running for president, of course, Jackson was running as president as a Democrat.
That's right.
And he's still part of the Democratic machinery. He still believes in the Democratic machinery. So we've seen how basically working as an operative, for the most part, for the Democratic machinery basically means that you are going to neutralize anything of real substance that you're going to implement for the black masses and the working class masses in general. The 2000 election was a prime example of that. Here you have a situation where the Republicans got caught red-handed knocking black people off the voting roll. Jeb Bush, Catherine Harris. The story was broken by Greg Palast beforehand. Jackson then got involved and saw for himself that 90,000 plus, majority of them black, people had been knocked off through this phony convict voting scam. You know, they used this software that basically was supposed to get ineligible workers off out of the 90 plus thousand that they scrubbed off the voting roll. 5%, if not less, were actual felons. They actually knocked off people in the year 2000. This was in the year 2007 they knocked off in the year 2000. So they used a time machine to go up to the year 2000 and find out that you were a felon or going to be a felon and then erased you from the voting roll in 2000. The whole thing was a sham. Jackson comes down. He starts to try to organize because the masses are fighting mad. And then Gore and the rest of the Democratic Party decide that it is better for them to maintain the false integrity of the system than to help unleash the masses' anger and help organize them against this monstrosity that happened for those who believe in the voting system. So they told Jackson to get out of town by sundown. And just like King got out of town by sundown when Kennedy told him to back in 1963 in the March on Washington, Jackson got out of town by sundown. Thereby, Jackson, as a Democrat, aligned with the Democratic Party more than with the basic rights of black people. That's in part what we're dealing with. So, many of these Negroes who are being looked to as taking the quote-unquote mantle to the next level, the best that they could do, like say they wanted to start a think tank. First of all, their whole ideology would send them to the corporations to get grants in the same way many of these conservatives do. And thereby, they would be neutralized from analyzing too harshly the imperialist grip that Sam is unleashing upon the world. So their relevancy would not resonate amongst many of the black masses that overwhelmingly are against these like imperialist wars from the start. And many other issues that they would be encumbered to take on if they were going to try to resonate amongst the masses. So, of course, why even go through it? They have their think tanks. It's all part of the regular corporate machinery. It's a gumpified machinery think tank. It's this droned out Fox News and all of that, all of them that call them to give them the image that they are head Negroes in charge or something. It's all an illusion. In other words, what I'm saying is that they're fitting into an apparatus that is there basically to handcuff the working class masses, and they don't want to disturb that. Now, if you look at the NAACP, here's a prime example. A few years back, some students were walking across the street during lunchtime from San Leandro High. And when some white students did, some police who were parked across the street saw them jaywalk and did nothing. When a couple of black students from San Leandro High did, the cops jumped out and tried to proceed to arrest them. A scuffle took place, and many of the students, seeing this contradiction and how ridiculous it was for these cops to arrest some students at lunchtime who were just walking to get something to eat, ended up in a fight, a brawl with the fight. Some of the cops got whipped up and embarrassed. Then a number of, you know, organizations, radical organizations, political organizations in general, came forward in support of the students. The NAACP then stepped in and started to go to the parents of the students and said, hey, I don't know about where this is going, because a lot of these people involved, they're pretty radical. And I don't know if you want your kids influenced by some of these radical organizations. So they pressured the parents, to the parents then pulled back their kids from participating in the collective network on a united front that many people were engaged in, and just basically left it into the hands of the NAACP, who did nothing, and the whole thing collapsed. And it got so bad that then, once it collapsed, the police started to turn on the students, who then had no protection. And one of the students had to move back to Oakland, where he had more family and more base, for his own protection, because when he was walking to and from school, the police would follow him, getting ready to pounce again. That shows you how inept. Intentionally, the NAA, they were willing to sacrifice teenagers so that they would not become too politicized and radicalized. That helps expose how their own contradiction, because they are embedded into the corporate capital democratic structure, they're fearful of independent organizing from the masses and an autonomous relationship by the masses to find out their own quest and mission.
So, absolutely. I want to just say, this is the fact, there's a role that the NAACP has been playing for some time now. So, for instance, in the Scottsboro case, it was rather similar. When the families of the Scottsboro defendants went to the NAACP and said, look, we need help, they're gonna lynch children. Some of these kids are just 10 years old. They're going to lynch them for rape? This is crazy. What was the NAACP's response? The NAACP responded, I'm sorry, folks, but we do not touch racial cases, sexual cases. They don't deal with sex. So, who stepped forward? The Communist Party stepped forward. They took the case and turned it into something. And in fact, while, you know, I wouldn't endorse their program and politics and everything they ever do, but they certainly did a good job with the Scottsboro case, to the point that they saved the lives of the Scottsboro boys, who were all going to be lynched, including the children. All right? Now, what is this saying? What are we? First of all, just for our listeners who may not know it, when we talk about HNIC, I have to say it once, and please don't go around using this language, but HNIC is a term used within our community to refer to the farce of these Negroes that have been installed by racists to pretend that they're looking over us. Actually, it's spy on us, basically. So HNIC means the head Negro in charge. Okay, that's what it really means. So our current black HNIC that we have here in America are not leaders at all. As Tracy just outlined, they're misleaders. But worse, as in the case of the NAACP that Tracy just explained, and this is in his lifetime, he saw this with his own eyes. They are obstacles to our struggle for liberation.
Now next, Andrea, the woman from the morning show on KPFA, asked Kelly about, is there a lack of black think tanks? Is that reasoning because of a lack of funds? Let's see how Kelly responds. Check it out.
Is part of what you think might be happening, Norman Kelly, that in fact when you talk about the lack of black think tanks, you talk about what Al Sharpton did for finances, is there a problem of a lack of resources? I mean, think tanks cost a lot of money. They need to be endowed, and where's that money going to come from?
Well, you know, well, somebody like, well, take West. West, basically, if you look to calculate, I did this. You know, I'm reading something some time ago that he was taking, and he takes in about $12,000 or more in lecture fees, so he gives close to $150,000. Well, you start over $150,000. You start calculating that, that's $2 million.
And your point about that is?
And my point is that there is money out there. And we now, as the last 4 years, we have a greater number of wealthy business people. I'm like, hip-hop itself has generated over $1 billion, you know. But once again, this is one of the problems within African-America. There is no, basically, assessment as to where we have been and what our holdings are and what it is that we do own. And what problems that we have, and what resources should be geared towards those problems. I'll give you a case in point. 25%, close to 25% of black America is still mired in poverty. Now, on one level, you can say that's a national problem, true. But I think one of the major faults that happened from the 60s is that black leadership never sat down and faced up to the fact that we have to sit down with our own people while we're getting things out of the dominant society through major pieces of legislation, sitting down saying, look, okay, guys, this is what we have. We have about 10 years to get some of these problems rectified. Because historically, anytime there is an improvement in the situation of African Americans, within 10 to 15 years, there will be a retrenchment. And you pretty much saw that in the aftermath of the Civil War era. And you pretty much saw that again in the aftermath of the Civil Rights Era. I think black politics pretty much collapsed in the early 80s when the Reagan administration came in and started cutting the social safety net, which affected a lot of African Americans, and black established leadership, black congressional caucus, NAACP, and Urban League, basically had no agenda other than, you know, the standards talking about civil rights or talking about this is a resurgence of racism. They never mobilized the African American community. I think the only kind of mobilization that you saw was Jesse Jackson's two campaigns. But they became pseudo political mobilization after 88, because afterwards he did nothing with that mandate that he had.
Okay, there's a number of things that need to be taken on in a sense on that. You know, when Kelly goes into the aspect about there's a lot of money that black people have access to, but they're not doing anything with it in a sense, you know, talking about like how, let's say Cornel West generates $2 million by himself just on speaking engagements. Well, I mean, a lot of that has to do with consciousness. If West is pulling the lever for John Kerry, which he did, then on a certain level, I can't expect that much from, someone whose ideology is tied within still the imperial structure. Now, the reason why I say that in part, it's not a total thing, an absolute thing, but the athletes of today have access at this time to more money on a personal level than they ever have been in the history of America. you know, all of these black professional athletes, so on and so forth. But if you look at the athletes of the 60s, Ali and so on and so forth, they were more engaged politically and more politically conscious. All anyone has to do is watch MTV Cribs and watch some of these Negroes in the NBA or football. And what do? First, they take you to their room where they have an oversized bed, usually a mirror hanging up, you know, so they can pose and stuff like that. Then they go into the oversized game room where all their little friends and hanger-ons in there, and they're all playing little video type games and stuff, and they all have, you know, this overextensive CD, DVD selection. Of course, Scarface is one of the collections. Then they go into the kitchen, and it's an oversized kitchen, even though most of the time they can't cook. Then they go into the backyard, and they have an oversized swimming pool, even though half of them can't swim. And then they go into the garage, where a number of them have, you know, Hummers and all of these cars and stuff like that, even though most of the time half of them are driving without a driver's license. So in essence, what I'm saying is none of them have any kind of book collection.
Right.
None of them have any kind of historical, you know, set up museum thing where they have like, you know, the piano, or one of the pianos Nina Simone played on, a horn from Coltrane, a horn from Dizzy, you know, any kind, you know, manuscripts from Frederick Douglass and all of that type of stuff. You know, all this stuff is accessible, but that's not where they're at. You know, so basically they got Scarface. That's the real world. So a lot of this, so you can have all the money in the world, but if your consciousness ain't there, then it just ain't there. Now, when Kelly goes into the aspect about the black leadership never mobilized black people, you know, especially during the attacks of the 1980s, I would argue that many of that Negro leadership at that time was intentionally demobilizing black people. Because, see, during the 80s, if you read and check up and analyze some of that type of stuff or what the hell was going on, you see that a lot of these cities and towns were getting elected black mayors and so on and so forth. And this was put forth as a model that this was an advancement for the people. But let's take one place in particular where the 80s was supposed to be a swinging upswing of black social advancement, Atlanta. In the 1980s, during this whole so-called black on the move through black faces in high places, moving on up and all of that type of stuff, the Wayne Williams case exposes all of it. Wayne Williams was framed for killing a number of black kids. Well, actually, he was only convicted of killing two, and one wasn't even a kid. It was like a 26-year-old man he was supposed to have thrown out of his window while he was driving across a bridge without stopping. Initially, the autopsy said the dude died of drowning. He had swimming trunks on, so that's what they figured, you know. But later, what happened is when they decided they were going to frame it all on Wayne Williams, they got all the other cases that were involved and just attached it to him without him being tried, and then they just closed the case, even though more kids kept getting killed even when Wayne Williams was in jail. It turns out that the police were doing their own investigation, and what they found out was that the Klan was involved in a number of these killings. Their own informants had recorded tapes of Klansmen targeting specific kids and those kids winding up dead. In conversation, what happened? The Negro leadership, these head Negroes in charge, along with the police, intentionally withheld that evidence from the courts, from black people, yeah, from Wayne Williams. Now, one would ask, why? Are these Negroes that sick? In a sense, yeah. Because what happened was black people lost confidence in the state. They lost confidence in the raggedy police. They lost confidence in the raggedy Negro mayors and all of that, Andrew Young and all these coons running around. And they said, we got to take this on our own. We got to organize ourselves. They formed bat patrols. They kept in constant communications anytime sisters were out with their little kids, stuff like that. The state feared that. Because, see, that's just, that's when you start taking the next steps into your own political development. Once you start to defend yourself and have your own community patrolling type stuff, then you start saying, well, you know, we're breathing in some bad air. Since we already got this thing rolling, let's take that on. And these schools, these raggedy-ass schools, ain't nothing changed, and it's the 80s. Let's deal with this again. So they didn't want that development to keep on going. So the head Negroes in charge were willing to help destroy the movement that was developing independently in the black community in Atlanta rather than see Klansmen, who were the culprits of this crime, be brought to justice. This is the type of savagery we're dealing with. These are the types of Negroes that are now in charge, quote unquote. You know, when I'm using the terms that Kelly's using.
Yeah.
You know, these are their little minstrel Negroes that they got dangling around on, you know, MSNBC and Fox News and all of that. It's a charlatan game. And it's a game that's not going to be tolerated, guaranteed, that much longer.
Actually, though, Tracy, you know what? Those old bootlickers, and you're right, because that's what they did, and I think the dynamic, as you explained it, is accurate. And not just Atlanta, but we could go to L.A. and all around the nation. But check this out, and this is the sad thing. This is the part I think you want to add to this. As soon as they finish using them Negroes, as soon as they manage to use them Negroes to demobilize and disorganize the community, and have the community laying on its back, defenseless, against all of these social attacks that we're suffering now. They drop them like a bad habit a New York minute.
That's what's so pathetic about these Negro collaborators, because it's clear that this has been going. I mean, look at how many times Jesse Jackson's been insulted, spit in the face, crying Bill Clinton, you know, the whole sister soldier thing, and on and on and on. But they're so deeply embedded in the corporate financial system. In part, they put a few dollars up these Negroes behind, stuff it up real tight with the American flag, wind them up, and the Negroes can't wiggle loose. It's that's what's really in part going on. Because you look at people like Armstrong Williams and stuff, they become satisfied economically and socially and all of that stuff, and then they start rationalizing. They start rationalizing, you know, stuff that is obviously in contradiction of what they're supposed to be standing for, and they just keep going on with the flow.
What's the sister's name that spoke up about the Castlemont situation? You know, at the movie theater, Castlemont High School?
Oh, you're talking about when...
the young sister who spoke up, when Pete Wilson came to school and all that.
Right, right.
You know, to denounce the kids for the Schindler's List. For laughing at the Schindler's List movie. Jesse Jackass was sent to Castlemont to, you know, put the Negroes back in place, make sure they don't get out of control and all that. And I remember being there when Jesse came to Castlemont. So, you know, Jesse came to quell, you know, any kind of rebellion, any kind of a collective that may have been formed there, just there among the students. That was his job. Come, you know, keep that in check, keep that under wraps. So when he came to Castlemont, we went to Castlemont to greet Jesse. And we went to boo Jesse, you know, and we booing Jesse, and Jesse had his henchmen come and surround us and wanted to get physical and rush us out the building.
Well, unfortunately, I wasn't there because not only would Jesse, actually, that would take care of a lot of the problems that later have happened. There'd be no more Jesse. And there'd be no more coons in alignment with Jesse.
No, but Trace, let's stay with this point that you made, though, about this rationalization.
Yeah,
because They can break with that stuff. It's not even in their interest at all times.
Well, of course they can. Of course they can. But wanting to is, I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, a lot of these clowns have a lot invested politically, socially. They become part of a particular network that says you're relevant as long as you stay within these particular parameters.
Exactly.
When you go outside of these parameters, well...
But that is really an illusion. Because the truth of the matter is, if these same people were to break with these false practices and this false consciousness and point out to the struggling masses the road to this political salvation, they could get a mass base.
And also, a lot of them do not want the type of mass base or be involved in the type of mass base that others of us do. In other words, they want to be head Negroes in charge. And when you have mass base of independent, collective black folks, this working things out and stuff like that, you have a natural organic thing where you see natural talent rise to the top. And many of these mediocre Negroes would just basically just fade out into the sunset. Now, next, Philip Maldry asked Kelly why he's not jumping on the Negro conservatives. Hold on a sec.
Well, you don't seem to have the same level of criticism for the conservative or neocon African Americans like Shelby Steele or Armstrong Williams. You seem to think that that they're actually pushing their case effectively.
Well, they are. They're
pushing. Well, maybe it's because they're backed by a lot of rich white conservatives.
Well, yeah. They are part of the apparatus. I mean, look, the liberals or left-of-center people like West and Henry Louis Gates and all these other people, they have access to money also, but they do nothing with it. They are more interested in, I think, supplying their own personal agenda. Black conservatives, you know, I expect them to do what they're supposed to be doing, which is to be the ideological or justification for the conservative movement. I expect that. Look, I'm being quite clear about this. There's only one political party in the United States right now, and that's the Republican Party, because they have a set of philosophy which they believe in, and they're organized. For instance, this just passed election just showed me how utterly incompetent the left is, because more people thought that Kerry was going to win. I never thought Kerry was going to win. I kind of entertained it that he could possibly win, but in my heart of hearts, I knew Bush was going to win. Why? It's like what journalist Ron Suskind has said. They have the machinery. One of the significant problems facing African Americans in the past 25 years, in the past 4 years, that African Americans have systematically taken down almost every institution that they had and developed during the Civil Rights era and not retool it for a new type of policy. I mean, basically, they are rushing to say we should go from protest to policy. Okay, that's fair enough. But you should also have institutions and mechanisms that will allow you to effectively engage in the political apparatus, you know. The Republicans are very good at propaganda. I mean, these guys are geniuses at that.
All right, now, when Kelly goes into how African Americans have systematically taken down every institution that they had, well, you know, first of all, some of these institutions and more autonomous ones were destroyed, you know, by COINTELPRO and things like that. Other institutions, basically, one could say that their autonomy was taken down, and that was in part not so much of just the various powers that be this crushing them into the ground, but these head Negro in charge types who actually believed in the system and who thought and think that a form of Negro integrationism i.e. just incorporating black people, this kind of illusion of black people incorporating themselves within the capitalist system of America is freedom itself, without understanding the whole dynamic and relationship of the capitalist system, its populations, portions of the populations in a capitalist system always needed to be underdeveloped and unemployed as an army of, you know, the unemployed reserve. All of these dynamics, black people's historical relationships into the market system, just because some Jim Crow laws were taken down doesn't mean all of a sudden that black people were going to be welcoming, you know, with open arms. It's the same type of illusion that some people have gone into concerning the South African thing, thinking that once Mandela was elected president, that this was some great step forward and stuff. White folks, 4% of the population during apartheid, controlled 80% of the land. Post-apartheid, white folks, 4% of the population, 80% of the land they control. And they're privatizing the land up like, and the industry up like mad as we speak, including water. A brother was arrested not too long ago for quote-unquote stealing water in South Africa. I mean, this is a type of, if you have a misunderstanding about how capital relationships actually work on the population, then you'll just have this illusion about capitalism, democracy, quote unquote, and all the other stuff that goes hand in hand with that particular aspect. Another thing is that, you know, as I said, a number of militant organizations were destroyed. Some, you know, flipped over by their own contradiction. But it has to be also looked as an attack on the working class as a whole. Many of the trade unions were undermined. All one has to do is read books like Labor's Giant Steps to get an understanding of the whole class nature attack of the capitalist system and the co-opting of many institutions. So once again, let's go back to this head Negro in charge stuff and concept, and expose how these people. Let's take New York. You have a situation in New York. They had a Mayor Dinkins at the time. This was once again by many of the head Negro in charge supposed to be proof positive of advancements for black people. Another interesting thing broke out, amongst others, in New York. That was the Central Park jogging case. Here you had a number of black and Latino teenagers who were arrested and convicted of raping a Central Park jogging woman, a white woman who was jogging through Central Park who was brutally and savagely attacked. It was clear from the beginning that they were being framed up, that those who did confess, it was coerced, and they didn't even have their parental guidance with them, which was illegal. Books like And the Blood Cried Out exposed the contradiction that none of their blood matched the blood semen that was found on the Central Park jogger, you know, the attacker, et cetera, et cetera. But during that whole process, Dinkins went along with the whole lynch mob attack against the black and Latinos, going along with the wording, wilding, and all of that type of stuff that was labeled. Went along with Trump, who took out full page ads saying, bring back the death penalty. And then went along with the laws that were changed to bring down the age limit for someone being tried as an adult. So they use this whole rebirth of a nation imagery to attack black people, Latino people, and the working class in general. Because when you're lowering the ages for teenagers in general to be tried as an adult, that's a whole class attack as a whole. And it all happened under the wing of this Negro Democratic, you know, governor. It turns
mayor.
It turns out the black teenagers and the black and the Latinos, they weren't the attackers at all. What? Over 10 years after the fact, the real attacker comes forward. He wasn't a teenager then. He's not a teenager now. He had nothing to do with those teenagers. The police framed the whole thing up.
And then still didn't want to admit it.
And didn't want to admit it. But on top of that, the way the structure is set up, you don't see any of these head Negro in charge types who just stood there neutralized and neutered when this attack was going on amongst against the black community. None of them have taken the mantle to try to challenge the whole setup and the barbaric nature of how people in general are framed up and savaged by this barbaric system. In other words, they're not challenging the system in any way because they're entrapped in it. They're entrapped by their own contradictions. It's the same type of entrapment that Al Sharpton found himself in when Amadou Diallo was shot at 41 times, hit, you know, a bunch of times when he was trying to enter into his house by these four maniac punk cops. What ended up happening? Al Sharpton, they had a trial. It was in the Bronx. It became apparent that the four cops were not being challenged that tough. So Al Sharpton calls up the Bronx district attorney. And people overhear him going in this big shouting match with the Bronx district attorney. And it basically ended up being a situation where Sharpton was accusing the district attorney of throwing the case. The district attorney was saying, "Don't you tell me how to run the case," and so on and so forth. And they both were basically making an Amos and Andy show out of it. How did this come about? And how did Sharpton get caught in this contradiction that he really was not able to mobilize anything against this district attorney? In part, was because the district attorney was a Negro district attorney that Sharpton helped get elected. And he got him elected by pushing forward that these black faces in high places is how we solve these crises and problems. So then this Negro... these Negroes in high place get this position, but he's like all these other little Negroes. He's a careerist. He wants to further his career. So this case comes along that's considered controversial. And this Negro knows, this district attorney, that if he goes after these cops tough, his career is over. His dreams of being possibly a mayor in the future or whatever is through. So he tap dances along. So then black people look over at Sharpton and say, "Hey, your coon that you asked us to help get this position, he ain't serving us. He's just looking out for himself. He's just on the minstrel line with the rest of y'all." So Sharpton calls up, "Look at you. What's going on? Why aren't you going after this dude? These cops are tough enough." And then the Sambo turns to Sharpton and says, "Well, you know why, Brother Sharpton? Is it because if I go after them too tough, that's the ends of my career. What about me?" And then Sharpton says, but what about me? I'm looking like a fool that I am." Because and what ends up happening? Black people left out in despair. Dispose of these coons on the plantation, because that's all they want to be.
But you notice, I couldn't help but to laugh with old Smarty going through his little routine there. But I tell you what, here's the saddest thing of it all. When that old boot licking, when he licked the police boots and let those cops get off, what did he get? Nothing. They still got rid of his sorry ass.
But he can now put it on his resume that when it came time to serve honorably his masters, even if it meant sacrificing himself, he did. So there's still hope for him. That's what he's doing. Now next, Andrea asked Kelly about Cornel West's attempt to reach youth with his hip-hop CD. So let's see how Kelly deals with this question. Check it out.
Norman Kelly, our guest, The Head Negro in Charge Syndrome, is his book, The Dead End of Black Politics, a controversial critique of black politics and intellectual leadership in America. We want to open our phone lines to callers who might want to ask a question of our guest at 510-848-4425, 510-848-4425. And, well, there's many things I want to ask you. Just to put a little meat on the bone of what you say about Cornel West, you basically called his album Sketches of My Culture a lame spoken word CD. You say he has had an unimpressive academic resume, and things like that. What do you think about the argument that he, in fact, one of the main things he's tried to do is connect to young people who otherwise are disengaged from the political workings, and that the way to do that is to do it by speaking their language, to do something like a CD with music that it brings up some political issues, brings up some intellectual issues. And
have you listened to that CD?
Yes, I have.
And you think it's really going to reach young people? I mean, they're listening to Gangster. I mean, I don't think it has anything to do with actually reaching young people on their terms. I think it's just a vanity ego project.
Let's go to...
Well, it's hard to argue on a certain level with that. I mean, West is, well, this on this one, just check out the CD. If you can find it, you know, don't pay your money for it. And listen to yourself and ask yourself, who the hell is this going to reach? And then just take it from there. I'll leave it at that.
Oh, you ought to be shamed, man. He tried, man. I don't know.
No, but...
Was it that bad?
Well, like Kelly said, who did he really think he was going to reach with that?
I don't know. But it ain't that bad a piece, though.
Okay, but yeah, but who is he going to reach with it?
Oh, don't be pointing at me, folks. I have the CD. I admit it, okay? Yeah, right, and I like it. Okay?
Now it's becoming clear.
Oh, that's right. It's becoming clear.
Next.
Next,
the caller. Man, oh, man. And next, the caller, Leon, asks Norman Kelly, that isn't what Cornel West doing the same thing as Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Doing. So let's see how Kelly deals with it. Check it out.
So Leon in Berkeley. Leon, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Good.
So I just want to say first to your guest that, you know, I admire that you're sticking to your guns and saying what you believe, and you're feeling a lot of heat right now from a lot of people and a lot of discomfort, and I don't necessarily agree with everything, but I think it's good that, you know, that you have the backbone to say what you say and deal with what people come to you with. That's one thing, but I want to say about Cornel West, I did go to college at Princeton, and at the time that he was there, first time, and I was around him and listened to some of his lectures, and I heard him since, and I always respected him a lot. But what I want to ask you is, you know, he's talking about a lot of the same kind of information that, say, Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Is talking about. He's just bringing up, I mean, I don't hear him going anywhere with it, but he's bringing up information, and don't you think it's important, at least, that we have different people in different parts and different strata of society who are at least informing people of what's going on, whether or not they have a whole program?
Norman?
Well, you know, I don't listen to... I used to work for the Pacifica Network as a volunteer producer. So, and I don't have much to say about my tenure in that era. If you want to believe that about West, go right ahead. I don't think he says anything that any other person hasn't said before, you know, in regards to certain issues. I just don't think he particularly says anything. I think we are now living in the society of the spectacle, where he as a performer is probably more important. People listen to that or respond to that more than anything that he actually says. To this day, I cannot come across one person who has told me anything that West has said in depth that sort of like shows some sort of like depth of knowledge. It's just, to me, just standard left of center pablum, social democratic pablum, which really sounds nice to the converted who already think like that and respond to that anyway. But I don't think it really shows any depth of knowledge or any really critical analytic thinking about looking at what's coming down the road. If you read his latest book on Democracy Matters, I mean, it's an embarrassment. It basically says nothing. He basically says nothing.
You know, some of this stuff that
Kelly saying also one has to kind of like, you know, like during that OJ trial, Cornel West was like in a conversation I saw in this magazine one time with this guy, Michael Lerner from Tycoon magazine. And Lerner's saying this crazy stuff about, you know, black people's response. He's implying it was irresponsible after the decision was made. And West was playing this kind of Negro defensive shuffle role instead of just saying, look, goddamn it. Instead of analyzing the whole thing of what went on during the trial, taking them on about a lot of the police corruption in places like L.A., deciphering the hidden racist messages that were being thrown out about the case, you know, codes and titles like Murder in O.J.'s Blood. These were some of the headlines when they tested O.J.'s blood, and they were slyly trying to say the genetics makeup of O.J.'s blood is connected to him being a murderer. In other words, some kind of biological destiny type thing. There were many types of things that were said by many commentators, you know, calling Johnny Cochran that the jury was hypnotized by Johnny Cochran's demonic, quote, Negro oratory. So when all of a sudden he gets into this kind of, you know, Negro preacher mode, and all the Negroes in the jury just become hypnotized. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Set him free. Set him free. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. I mean, this is how crazy these fools were. Man, I would have slapped Lerner all over the place. But West, I mean, just, you know, I would suggest people check out, you know, the Slave Revolt blog and see some of the, you know, we've done stuff on West before in particular, especially when he was talking about pulling that lever for the mass murderer Carey. And also on Henry Louis Gates, the two-part thing we did on Gates and stuff, to examine, you know, some of the background of some of these so-called Negro intellectuals for yourself. Hold on a sec. We'll be right back.
the media. How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth?
You know what time it is. We wrap this up. We're going to go into a segment, Ventures in Corporate Media Land. What we're going to deal with is the Eichmann Media Machine. Recently, Ward Churchill, the noted writer of Pacifism as Pathology, and the counterintelligence paper, COINTELPRO papers, Agents of Repression, and another book called A Little Case of Genocide, has found himself in hot water over the statements he made 4 years ago in a book. We're going to examine how this type of stuff is playing itself off in the corporate media land segments and circles. But first, here's Churchill speaking to an audience in his own words about accusations that have been tossed at him. So first off, let's see what he has to say himself. Check it out.
Now, a number of things have been imputed to me. But what shall I call this? The Boulder Denver equivalent of the National Enquirer at this point. Or the Star. Couldn't make the case on the issue, and so now my pedigree becomes the issue. Can you call me? I got a very important question. I get a call today from an unregistered Irishman. Okay? Very important question. Can you put me in touch with some of your buddies from Vietnam? We're going to send a film crew to your high school. These people haven't seen me in 40 years. They have nothing to do with this. The issue was not sustainable, so I am to become the issue. Well, later for that. Later for that. My identity does not come from some punk editorial page editor at the Rocky Mountain News or the Boulder Daily Camera. I am the man, it is said, on the talk shock radio in the Denver area who has called for the deaths of millions of Americans. Someone show me where I said that. I am the man who has justified what I consider to be natural and inevitable. You do not justify the natural or the inevitable. You make comment on it. You don't have to advocate it. You don't have to justify it. You simply point to it. No, I did not call. A bunch of food service workers, janitors, children, firefighters, and random passers-by, little Eichmann. It says clearly in that passage, which perhaps I should have amplified further in terms of the connotation of Eichmann, because I understood people would understand as I did what Eichmann symbolized, but apparently not. It says clearly in that passage, the reference is to a technical core of empire, the technicians of empire. Someone want to give me a coherent definition by which someone who is 18 months old or someone who serves food for a living, or someone who pushes a broom, or someone who is trying to save people in the building, or someone who was just walking by becomes a technician of any sort. Obviously, I was not talking about these people. I was talking about some very specific technical tricks to make this particular system hum, and I'm going to come back to that in a second. But the people at issue, and these are the only people who have been raised, the construction is fairly clear. I've been told it was a bad rhetorical device. Well, I don't think so. You got a better rhetorical device, go use it. Make people think about this your way. This was mine. All right, Commander, let's...
All right, basically, what Churchill was saying is that he wasn't calling for the death of all the particular individuals who got killed to take place. It was basically a thing of him calling for the technocrats. And the thrust of much of his argument seemed to be based in a thing also from a national standard and concept of what do people in America think is going to continue to happen when the U.S. government in American people's name continue to pulverize much of the planet. So when Churchill was, you know, like down here in Oakland speaking, he basically, this is like over a year ago, he basically had that same thrust to, you know, his speech and stuff like that. Reg actually has some of the direct quote. And I'm going to let him go over some of that type of stuff. Oh, hold on a sec.
Yeah, he was saying, on explaining some of the issues, the points he made about his statements, some things are taken out of context, he said. Like when he said that when he talked about Little Eichmann's characterizing, as James said, only to those described as so-called technicians. He said, thus, it was obviously not directed to the children and janitors, food service workers, firemen, random passerbyers killed in the 9-1 attack, which is what he said on his speech.
Now, let me say something about that. You know, some of the stuff, it seemed like he was, in his book and stuff, just trying to be this kind of cavalier about it. Basically, for those of us on the radical side of things, it's up to you to decide whether you agree or disagree. The reason why I mention this is to hell with all of these little punks on the right who have their own particular agenda. These cats are not in this fight to basically make sure that decency and respect for all is spoken in universities or wherever you are. They're using this as a social control mechanism. I mean, remember when 9/11 first happened and it looked like Boy George was headed towards war, the first thing that started to take place was people in the administration started to put pressure on people in the universities and the higher ups to ostracize people who were anti-war. So here, they didn't have any tolerance towards anyone who wasn't waving the flag. This is the same society that allows the Michael Savages of the world go out and spew hate speech against blacks, gays, and third world people all the time, who he commonly refers to as third world people. Yet, Michael Savage is syndicated all over the place, and punks like Clint Eastwood often, I've heard him call into his show and give the praise to Michael Savage for bringing the truth and things of that nature. So, in other words, this is not really an argument to, quote-unquote, bring decency to a society or to the airwaves or anything like that. These guys have a whole ream of savages who hold most of the world in contempt. And basically, they have their own agendas set forth. One,
is to try to destroy the tenureship. So, like many other times, they've tried this attack on tenureship at universities. They're using this as an excuse to try to erode the tenureship, which gives a certain amount of leeway and barrier for university professors and what have you to express themselves without fear of the state coming down with its tyrannical arm. Now, to show you how far these savages really want to push it, here's Punk O'Reilly, you know, from the O'Reilly Show. Let's see what O'Reilly's shooting for concerning this whole Churchill thing. Check it out.
The treason potential charge first. It's Article 2, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution. Quote, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. So aid and comfort to the enemy, does that cover it?
Well, you know, as you said, there must be an overt act witnessed by two witnesses, an intent to betray the United States, and then that act provides aid and comfort to the enemy. And, you know, this is a very unique crime in the United States. It's the only crime listed in the U.S. Constitution. So the framers not only put the crime in there, but defined it. They paid that much attention to it. So it's not something to be taken lightly, and the framers made it as such.
Okay, would you, the last treason case was brought in 1949 in the USA. Do you think that Churchill runs the risk of being tried for treason here?
In my opinion, Bill, no. There have only been 30 prosecutions in the history of the United States. The last eight or so related with World War II, which you're talking about, the last one being about that time frame in the early 50s. Of those, five of those eight dealt with propaganda cases, people who were either working on the radio broadcasts of the Nazis or the Japanese, really trying to demoralize the troops. They were convicted of treason, and I think rightfully so.
Okay, but wait a minute now. You know, Tokyo Rose and these other people, they were working, getting paid for the foreign governments. We don't suspect Churchill's getting paid for by Al-Qaeda or anything like that, but certainly he's demoralizing particularly Americans who lost people on 9/11 and giving aid and comfort to Al-Qaeda by saying they have a right to attack us because we kill babies or whatever insane thing he's ranting. Aid and comfort, sir?
No, I don't think we're there. I think it'd be a very difficult charge to prove. It's a very rigorous contract. Legal scholars agree that it's actually harder to prove treason than it is to prove mass murder. Now, what this guy said, obviously grotesque distortions, distasteful to every person hearing it, and the reality of it is that you get into that issue where freedom of speech ends and where treason would begin, and I don't think that we could prove the end.
Now it's clear once again. See, this is what these clowns are really shooting for. Here you have O'Reilly talking about trying Churchill for treason. And part of his argument is that he's saying stuff that's demoralizing to the victims. And he's giving, quote unquote, aid and comfort to Al-Qaeda. So this is the same station that has Oliver North producing a show on Fox. Here's a person who's really been involved in treason to humanity. So when they talk about treason for some speech that you may or may not agree with, and it's part of his little political polemic. And then you got some gangster like Oliver North, alive and well, producing shows. You can see what this whole thing is really about. This is about power and social control. So part of the reason why, because I had the book that he had and read some of this stuff. But on a certain level, I refuse to get into this little game that they want you to play where you go back and forth saying, should he said it, should he not have said it, and all of this type of stuff. When in reality, on a certain level, it's irrelevant. If we amongst ourselves agree that that's the right tactic or strategy or polemic, that's one thing. But to allow these clowns to get into their little crucified mode and not see that they have their real agenda is not about freedom of speech or anything like that. The mere fact that you got Sorry O'Reilly talking about is this a thing for treason? And the person he's talking to, he's not even a lawyer or anything. He's just some raggedy commander dude. So this is just a process for them to propagandize this particular issue through their little corporate media network to help get a consensus amongst their gumpified masses to help loosen up the laws for their own class enemies. And they're using the media network to destroy freedom of speech, to try to destroy tenureship, to basically humble down and frighten into a form of self-censorship anyone who has a criticism amongst this barbaric network. Meanwhile, Boy George, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, they committed treason against humanity with their lies and excuses for going ahead and bombing up Iraq, which literally cost millions. These Eichmanns were involved in costing the lives of millions. You got other clowns like Rumsfeld being involved in little clandestine covert operations like the Strategic Support Branch that is operating outside of the network of the knowledge of even representatives in this silly society. Now, talk about treason against their own laws. Yet they want us to get all hyped up about a professor statement and stuff. See, this is the games that they played. But next, let's go into O'Reilly right quick as he goes and talks to this commander guy into the sedition charges that may be able to be thrust at Churchill. Check it out.
Let's go to sedition, a federal crime supporting revolution against the government. Certainly he's doing that. Or supporting an enemy of the nation during a time of war through speeches, publications, and organizations. Certainly he's doing that. Problem is we're not in a time of war because Congress hasn't declared war.
Right.
Can you get him on sedition? Anyway.
No, I don't think we can. I mean, you know, this guy, I think the only thing we can charge him with at this point is exceeding his 15 minutes of fame and give him a one-way ticket back to obscurity. This guy is not someone who's going to rise to the level of treason or sedition. And sedition really is there for someone trying to overthrow the government, help overthrow the government. This guy's a bit player, and it wouldn't rise to that level.
Okay, because, you know, but he wants the government to be overthrown, but the fact that he doesn't have the power to do it or he's not aiding the enemy in a material way, you would say that that doesn't rise.
Probably not, Bill. That's correct.
All right. So there's really, this guy can continue to hurt people, and by hurting people, on 9/11 families particularly, with his speech, his hate speech, because he hates his country. And we can't, the authorities really can't do anything about it. That's about it.
No, I don't think they can.
All right, Commander, we appreciate you coming on in and defining the force.
So once again, here's Raggedy O'Reilly. See, this is the media Eichmann rallying his little droned out troops to get all hyped up and get into this kind of Nazified mode to slash away basic free speech rights and then try to take it not just to the level of getting him fired, but actually try to give him prison time. If O'Reilly had his way, as you heard O'Reilly say about the sedition charges, can we charge him with that? That, you know, after all, he's supporting revolution, you know, by saying that the things he said about the 9/11 attacks. So O'Reilly is basically flipping the script from Churchill basically saying, hey, sometimes the chickens fight back, you know, to the point of that being aid and comfort to the quote unquote terrorists and also supporting revolution, as if what those guys were doing is, has anything to do with. Basically, they learned the same terroristic tactics. They use the same terroristic tactics that they learned from their master. And then they all collaborated together on 9/11 to perform the little hit. So O'Reilly and all of this propaganda is just designed in this kind of Nazification Eichmann role to get people stirred up, to basically slash away even the most basic rights that people have of self-expression.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Also, I just wanted to say that, you know, from my understanding, you know, college professors, teachers, I think it's as low as even high school teachers, they have to sign a contract when they become teachers to renounce communism. They can't teach quote-unquote communism in the schools, you know. And Churchill, you know, wasn't saying, you know, hey, you know, let's form communism, so on and so forth, you know. So he hasn't even like breached the clause in the contract, you know, as far as we know, you know what I'm saying. You know, they're going to use that to try and roll on them, because basically that's exactly what they want to do, is roll back any kind of criticism, any kind of analysis.
Right.
That can be landed, you know, or provided in an alternative viewpoint that's a radical analysis about the way things work in this backwards-ass system.
Yeah, they want no critique at all. And it's basically the same way that they have all these surveillance systems that are being synchronized more and more to basically give people the impression, rightfully so, that every step they take, the empire has an eye on you, and any misstep is basically could be your last step. Well, by the same token, they're doing that on a psychological level to people like professors, where they want to send them out a message that anything you say that we consider antagonistic against our overall imperialist aims can come back and haunt you and cost you even your freedom. Now, when you're dealing with a savage empire like that, it's not about, quote unquote, whether you particularly agree with Churchill's polemic or not. Because the reality is that this happens to be something that they felt that they could ratchet up. But as they're turning up the screws of their imperial crusades, anything, basically, that anyone says that goes outside of the bounds of what the empire finds appropriate will be attacked viciously and will be used to try to toss you in their own capitalist hell until we put them in theirs. Hold on a sec. Just gonna about wrap it up for Slave tonight. It's clear that these prophets of the sea are trying nothing other than to contain us in their own particular spectrum of death. But what we have to do is keep shooting wild in the wind, at least at our enemies. Until the next time, Slave Revolt. Out.